divide and rule as an ethical value. Abstinence from slandering is a noble virtue, but some people consider it advisable to resort to calumny under certain circumstances for their own ends. In ancient times, kings employed deceptive tactics to create discourse among their united enemies, and so they achieved victory. King Ajatasattu defeated the united Lichavis by means of this kind of stratagem. He first banished his minister, the Brahmin Vasakara, under the pretext of punishing him for some offence. Vasakara went to Vasali. Some Lichavi princes said that the Brahmin was very cunning and objected to his residence in their city. But most of them had no suspicion, because they believed that his banishment was due to what he said in their favour. So they welcomed him and entrusted him with the education of their children. In order to gain the confidence of the public, the Brahmin at first taught the young princes properly. The princes held him in high esteem and regarded him as their reliable teacher. Then the Brahmin sought to create discord and misunderstanding among them. The way he did it was subtle. He would call a prince and ask him in whisper, "Have you had your meal? What curry did you eat?" His question was designed to make other princes suspicious. Again, he would ask another prince in whisper, "Does your father plough with two oxen?" Thus there was an air of secrecy about his questions and the manner of asking them. The prince, who was questioned by the Brahmin, became an object of suspicion by others. He said that he did not know what to make of the Brahmin's questions, but they thought he was only lying. Then the Brahmin asked another prince whether he was afraid, as reported by a friend of his named so-and-so. Naturally, the prince was offended at what he believed to be calumny on the part of his friend. In this way, Vasakara set the princes by the ears, and in a matter of 3 years, they were so much divided among themselves that they hated to see one another. Then Vasakara sent a message to King Ajatasattu that it was high time for him to seize Vesali. Ajatasattu marched onto the city with his troops. The alarm was sounded by the beating of war drums. But since the princes were not united, no one came out for the defence of the city. They sulked at home, doing nothing. So there was no resistance, and Ajatasattu took the city easily. And this is an example of divisive tactics based on calumny and leading to victory. An example that teaches us valuable lessons. Today, politicians and others engaged in worldly affairs employ deceptive tactics for their own ends. Propaganda involves many talks that are intended to discredit one's opponents. Even in matters of religion, some make remarks that are harmful to others. any remark that is calculated to discredit or arouse hatred against a person or persons is calumny. But some people have a high regard for a person who is not worthy of respect, and you may have to speak ill of him by way of warning them against an illusion that is detrimental to their own interests. This kind of remark is not slanderous and evil. The dictionary has for calumny, by the way, my note. The making of false and defamatory statements in order to damage someone's reputation, slander, a false and slanderous statement. Overcoming slander. But you should avoid making any remark that will create misunderstanding and discord. Your words should serve to infuse others respect for the person who is worthy of respect and unite those who are on the verge of conflict. If you hear someone being criticized through misunderstanding, you should counsel restraint. You should appease the critic, saying, "This man would not have spoken such a thing," or, "He might have said it not with ill will, but with the best of his intention." The Buddha describes abstinence from slander as follows. The man who is committed to such abstinence avoids talebearing. He brings about reconciliation among those who are divided. His words strengthen the unity of those who are already united. He delights in seeing people in harmony. He loves harmony, and so he will make only the remarks that tend to encourage harmonious relationship. Therefore, we should not convey the slanderous remark of a person to another person concerned. We should not tell a person about the faults of another. We should utter only words that are discreet and beneficial. We should make only remarks that are conducive to unity, remarks such as, "Your friend often extols you for your honesty, broad-mindedness, and capabilities." When we hear someone speaking ill of another, we should say, "What you say may not be true. Perhaps you have misunderstood him, or he has made a mistake sincerely. He is a very good man. He could not have made such a senseless remark. He should not support a disparaging remark. Instead, we should say something that will mollify a person's anger." Such words help to avert conflict that is likely to occur, or to restore unity among those who are divided. So we should practice the Salaka Dhamma of abstinence from slander, Salaka Vara. Cultivate thoughts relating to it, Chitupada Vara. Avoid slander by following the path of abstinence from it, Parikamana Vara. Abstain from slander for our spiritual uplift, Upari Bhagavara. Avoid slander for the attainment of Nibbana. There are people who are by nature free from the habit of slandering, and there are those who avoid it because of their firm commitment to moral precepts. This is the extinction of defilement rooted in the transgression by word of mouth, an extinction that is based on inborn or self-imposed morality. This kind of extinction is good, and it is commended in Salaka Sutta. But one should not remain content with it, for it is not permanent. Although you are now free from the defilement, you are not assured of the same freedom in your next existence, So it is necessary to root out on the plane of the noble ones, Aryamaga. Such Aryan or total extinction is called Samucheda Virati, absolute abstention. One of the three kinds of Virati that I have explained in my third sermon. Karmic effects. Anguttara Nikaya mentions the karmic effects of slandering. It says that the slanderer is liable to land in the netherworld, and that if they are reborn as a human being, they will be at odds with their relatives and friends. The more they are slanderous, the more karmic evil there is in store for them. Those who utter slander against good and virtuous persons will have to pay dearly for their evil words. The karmic rewards for abstinence from slander are just the opposite. One who abstains from slander will enjoy heavenly bliss, and on return to the human world will have happy and harmonious relations with friends and relatives. The following is a story about a woman who had to suffer after her death because of her slanderous talks. It concerns both men and women and is worthy of note. The story of Isidasi Teri. In the lifetime of the Buddha, and for nearly 1,000 years after his parinibbana, there were bhikkhunis, the female members of the Buddhist Sangha. The scene of the story is laid out at Pataliputta, a city that arose and became famous in post-parinibbanic period. And so the events might have occurred after the Buddha's parinibbana. But since the story is to be found in the Pali Pitaka, it apparently relates events before the Second Council, or events that took place within 100 years after the Buddha's decease. One day, two Teris, Isidasi and Bodhi, sat on the clean white sandbank of the Ganges near the city of Pataliputta. Both were arahats, with all of their biases, the asavas, or unwholesome tendencies, totally extinct. They sat in a contemplative mood, breathing fresh air and watching the cool, clear water of the river. Then, as she looked at her companion, Bodhi Teri was struck by her beauty and youthfulness. By and large, young and pretty women are sunk in sensual pleasures. They seldom visit holy places, let alone entertain any idea of joining the holy order. Bodhi Teri wondered what unusual circumstances had led Isidasi to become a bhikkhuni at her tender age. So she asked Isidasi, "My friend, the world should be a happy place for a young and attractive woman like you. So what was your disappointment or your disillusionment with life that made you join the holy order?" Then Isidasi told her story. The only daughter of a merchant, of good moral character in Ujjaini, She was much beloved by her parents. Ujjaini is the Ujjaini of Bhopa state in middle West India. It is not far from the famous stupa at Sanchi. When Isidasi came of age, a rich merchant of Saketa in middle North India sought her hand in marriage with her son. Saketa was far away from Ujjaini, and in those days it took probably 2 or 3 months by bullock cart or carriage. The two families, being well matched in respect of social status and wealth, Isidasi's parents agreed to the proposal. After marriage, she lived in the house of her mother-in-law, in accordance with the Indian custom. As a girl of good upbringing, she revered her husband's parents as her own, paying customary respect to them twice a day. In India, it is still customary for young people to do obeisance to parents, parents-in-laws, and elders. On our way to Sri Lanka, in connection with the 6th Buddhist Council, we stopped at Madras to call on a well-to-do Indian. The Indian was out, so we had to wait for him at his house. When he came back, his wife and all the other inmates of the house paid respect to him. It is their way of greeting. Elderly people too greet one another by raising their palms, hands with palms placed together. There is no such custom in Burma, and it is not usual to make obeisance to parents and elders. Public respect is accorded only to images of Buddha, pagodas and bhikkhus. Animists pay respect to gnats, to spirits, but they do not show the same gesture towards their fellow beings. All this is due to lack of training. Some even do not know how to pay respect to their parents. Some, however, make it a practice to show respect to the elders in the month of October, the end of Buddhist Lent. Some children do not hesitate to pay respect to their parents and elders because they have been trained to do so. This is a very good habit of a cultured society, and every parent should implant it in their children. Isidasi was courteous to her husband's brothers and sisters as well. She gave up her seat when they came and provided them with food. She approached her husband respectfully with her hands and feet washed and cleaned. She groomed his hair, gave him a looking glass, and applied a brown lotion to his eyes in Indian fashion. She arranged his clothes like a slave girl. She prepared his meals herself instead of leaving the job to her servants. She washed the dishes and pots too. In short, she served her husband tenderly, like a mother attending to the needs of her only child. Her fulfillment of the wife's obligation should have been gratifying to every man. Yet by an irony of fate, 1 month after the marriage, her husband hated her bitterly and told his parents that he could not live with her any longer. They asked why. He disliked his wife, who was in their eyes a good, hard-working and conscientious woman. The young man said that his wife gave him no trouble, but that in spite of her good character, he did not love her any longer. If his parents insisted on his marital fidelity, he would have to leave the house. So the merchant and his wife asked Isidasi
what mistake she had made in her relation with her husband. Isidasi replied in sorrow that she had said or done nothing that might offend or make him unhappy, and that she had served him with respect and deep affection. If in spite of her faithfulness he hated her, she could not help it. They were convinced of Isidasi's innocence, but their sense of justice was outweighed by their love and attachment to their son. So they sent her back to her parents, although they were unhappy for the loss of their charming daughter-in-law. As will be shown later, the young man's hatred for his innocent wife was due to her evil karma in the past. But the fault did not lie entirely with her. The man's dislike of Isidasi might also be attributed to his lack of karma that was good enough to make him worthy of a noble woman like her. We will explain it later. Isidasi's father was confident of her ability to get another good husband, and he married her to the son of a well-to-do second-rate merchant. Isidasi served him respectfully, but again after a month, her husband said that he could not live with her. She was later sent back to her parents. Then her father thought that it was their wealth and that had made her husband's and their parents so arrogant and cruel to her. So he looked for a poor man who would suit his daughter. Before long, there came a good-looking beggar. The merchant gave him new clothes and persuaded him to live comfortably in his house as his son-in-law. But after a fortnight, the beggar changed his mind and said that he wished to leave the house. The parents and relatives of Isidasi entreated him not to leave them, but it was in vain. He said that he could not live any longer with Isidasi in the same house. Then he deserted his wife. The working out of karma is at times very surprising. The beggar's reluctance to live comfortably in the merchant's house as his son-in-law might probably be due to the inadequacy of his karmic potential for such a better life. The beggar was like the man in Mahasadhara Jataka who deserted his wife. The story of Udambara Devi. In the Mithila city of the kingdom of Videha, there was a young man called Pingutara who went to Takasila for his education. As he was an intelligent youth, he accomplished his object in a short time. And so he took leave of his master to return to his native place. It was the familiar tradition of the master to marry his grown-up daughter to his pupil. At that time, the master had a marriageable daughter of great beauty, and so he married her to his pupil. Pingutara was poor in his karmic potential, and therefore he had no love for the master's daughter, who, as a girl of high karmic potential, was ill-matched for him. But since he did not wish to displease his master, he agreed to accept her as his wife. When at night the bride got onto the bedstead in the bridal chamber, Pingutara stepped down and slept on the floor. When the girl in duty, bound, followed him and lay down to sleep beside him, he shifted onto the bedstead.
but he got down at once when the girl again followed him. In this way the girl slept on the bedstead while he slept on the floor for 7 days. This shows the incompatibility of two karmic potentials of opposite nature. After a week, Pingutra paid respect to his teacher and left Takasila with his wife. They did not speak to each other during the whole journey. When they came near the Mithila city, they saw a water fig tree laden with ripe fruits. Pingutra climbed up the tree and ate some fruits. His wife asked him to drop some fruits for her, but he told her to get onto the tree herself. When she was up on the tree eating the fruits, he got down and fled after encircling the foot of the tree with thorns. Surely he was cruel, but he had to abandon his wife because he was not deserving of her. Before long, the king of Videha arrived by chance near the tree. Seeing the beautiful lady of Takasila on the tree, he fell in love with her. So he made inquiries as to whether she was married or unmarried. She told the king who she was and how she was left on the tree by her husband, whose whereabouts she did not now know, and how she was in trouble, being unable to climb down. The king concluded that she had no husband to claim her, and so after letting her come down, he made her his queen. She was named Udambara Devi, queen of the water fig tree, after the name of tree on which she was found. One day the villagers near the city gate were ordered to repair the road in anticipation of the king's visit to the garden. As one of the villagers, Pingutra was working on the road when the king and queen came along in a royal chariot, accompanied by the ministers and courtiers. On seeing Pingutra with his loincloth tucked up and a spade in his hand among the village labourers, the queen could not help laughing. The king asked her why she laughed. The queen pointed out her former husband and said that his inferiority complex had struck her so ludicrous as to make her laugh. But the king did not believe her. He said, "You are lying to me. You must have laughed because you saw a man whom you love. I must kill you." So saying, he took out his sword. The queen was frightened and implored the king to consult some wise men about her statement. The king then asked the minister, Senaka, for his opinion. Senaka replied that no man would have deserted a beautiful woman like her. Senaka's reply terrified the queen very much, but having some doubts about his wisdom, the king decided to seek the opinion of Mahosada, or wise minister. So he asked Mahosada whether it was possible for a man to dislike and abandon a beautiful and virtuous woman. Mahosada replied, "Your Majesty, the man who abandons a beautiful and virtuous woman may be one who has low karmic potential. Therefore, I believe that it is possible for a man to dislike such a woman. A person of high karmic potential is never compatible with another person of low karmic potential. It is not in the nature of things to find them together." Only when he heard Mahosada's answer did the king accept the queen's statement, and his love for her remained intact. But for Mahosada, he would have acted on the advice of the foolish Seneca and lost the worthy queen. He owed the life of his beloved queen to Mahosada. And so as a mark of gratitude, he presented him with a large sum of money. Sainaka's answer was erroneous. Moreover, it was a kind of calumny that served to aggravate the situation that was already tense because of the king's suspicion. It was not the kind of answer that should be given by counselors. On the other hand, Mahosadar's answer was reasonable and true. It was also meant to remove discord and restore harmony between the king and the queen. Such are the words of the wise, free from slander and worthy of emulation by all counselors. It is obvious that Pingutra's desertion of Udambara Devi was due not to evil karma of the latter, but to the low karmic potential of the former. Likewise, Isidasi was deserted by the beggar because he did not have the good karma that would ensure a good life in the house of the merchant. So also the desertion by her two former husbands was not wholly due to her bad karma, but it might be attributed in part to their karma that was too poor for their association with a noble woman.